I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. It's a politics-rich and book-heavy hour on today's show. We'll hear from former Senator George Mitchell, who joined us last year to discuss his role in ending the conflict in Northern Ireland and his failure to do the same in the Middle East. His memoir is The Negotiator. We'll also listen to my interview with biographer John Meacham about the life and presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. His book on Bush is called Destiny and Power. But first, we'll hear from President Obama's former senior strategist, David Axelrod. He joined us to discuss his book, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. We begin our politics-rich edition of today's show by listening to my interview with David Axelrod. He's been involved with many political campaigns over the years, most notably for Barack Obama's 2008 and 2012 presidential runs. He joined us last year to discuss President Obama as well as his memoir called Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. Let's take a listen. Do you think of yourself as a messenger? Not messenger, but messenger?
I do think that. That is the essence of what I did. You know, you only have a brief period of time in any campaign interaction to actually reach people. And there may be 100 things you can say about your candidate, about a campaign, about the other candidate. And the question is, which few are really meaningful to people on things that are fundamentally important to them? And that involves – and how do you weave them together in a coherent story about what this is about? And that's the strategic challenge in every campaign. That's what I found so invigorating, is this process of getting to that core and then finding ways to communicate those messages.
What was your first impression of the first time you met Barack Obama?
It's a funny story, Marty. I met him because a friend of mine called me. This woman named Betty Lou Saltzman is a kind of a doyen of liberal politics in Chicago. And she called and said, this was in 1992, I just met this remarkable young man. He just came back from Harvard Law School, and I think you ought to meet him. And I said, I'm happy to meet anybody. You want me to meet Betty Lou, but why? She said, I think he could be the first black president of the United States. And I thought that was pretty grandiose, but I went and I met him. And I didn't, as I said in the book, walk away humming Hail to the Chief. But he was very impressive, and he was impressive in part because he had just come from Harvard, where he was the president of the Harvard Law Review, and he could have written his ticket at any corporation, at any law firm in America, and instead he came back to Chicago, where he had been a community organizer, to organize a voter registration drive and to practice civil rights law in a small civil rights firm, in a small law firm. And I thought, and as I talked to him, it was very clear to me that he was someone who saw public life as a calling, politics as a calling. I always say the world of politics divides into two categories, one more numerous than the other. The big category are people who run for office because they want to be something. And then there's a smaller category of people who run because they want to do something. And those are the people that excite me. Those are the people I'm attracted to. And I could see from the beginning that this young man, who obviously had ambitions to run for public office, was the kind of person who should be in public office.
It's not clear to me that he likes politics.
That comes up a lot, and it's really interesting to me because it depends how you define politics. He isn't a brilliant guy when he gets out in the campaign trail. He loves mixing with people. Does he love the politics of Washington? No, I would say he does not. I think he gets frustrated with the politics of Washington, the smallness of the politics in Washington. And a lot of his attitude toward politics is interpreted through that prism of Washington politics. But I was with him. I remember in 2012 we'd had a difficult period before, in the year before, going into that campaign. But when he got out on the campaign trail, it was like a tonic for him. We did a bus tour through Ohio, and just to be able to mix with people and, you know, not politicians, but civilians, you know, citizens. He was invigorated by that, and that's who he is.
Well, and we're obviously talking about a complicated person, Barack Obama, but I'm also thinking about how he is on the campaign trail, and then you see his press conferences in the White House.
Yes.
These, you know, 7-minute answers that he gives.
Yes.
And it looks like thinks he's at the dentist.
Yes. Well, we're on radio, so people can't see, but you can attest to the fact that I don't have very many hairs on my head.
Is that
and
Barack
many
Obama's
of them,
fault?
Many of them were lost sitting there in those press conferences as he answered those questions. And this is something. This was a battle that I had with him throughout his presidency, because his attitude was campaigns are campaigns, and you speak thematically in campaigns, and you have a message, and you bang that message. The presidency requires that you answer every question in detail. And, you know, he took to heart too much the old Mario Cuomo maxim that you campaign in campaign in poetry and govern in prose. There has to be some poetry and also some message discipline in the presidency as well. And this was a constant tug and pull between us when I was in the White House and after.
But behind the scenes, would he get angry at things, you know, when people would talk about his birth certificate or being born in Kenya? I mean, publicly, he would either sort of laugh it off or let
no,
it roll
and
off.
Privately as well. He one of his qualities is that he has a very well developed sense of the absurd, and he's a writer. He's a writer. First and foremost, I would describe him as that, you know, in terms of his disposition. So he has the ability to sort of step outside the scene and look at it and appreciate the absurdity of it. The whole birther thing was so ridiculous. You know, I never really heard him say, you know, blow up, and he did kind of laugh at it, but we had to dispose of it in some way. But the funny thing about that was, I think the time he really disposed of it was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, when he had, you know,
the
basically
Donald,
made sport
right?
of Donald Trump, who was leading the birther movement, and he just destroyed him there and kind of put the whole thing to bed.
He also has been criticized, maybe more from the left than from the right, being the first African-American president, that he has not done enough to address the problems of discrimination, our racial legacy. Yes, he did talk about Trayvon Martin and some other incidents, but I think people were thinking he had this bully pulpit to help us understand and address our legacy of racism, and he hasn't done it to their satisfaction.
Right. But what my answer to that is twofold. One is everyone has to understand the circumstances under which this guy became president of the United States. We walked into that door as essentially a triage unit trying to save the American economy from collapse. We were told there's a 1 in 3 chance of a second Great Depression. We met for months several times a day as the economists sort of took the vital signs of the American economy. And, you know, and this was in the midst of two wars and other challenges as well. And there's no doubt that had we arrived at a different time, we would have apportioned his time, and he would have apportioned his time differently. I think he has, especially in the later years, begun to address these issues. But job number one was to save the country from a calamity of untold proportions. And within that, by the way, he was the guy who fought for expanded earned income tax credit, refundable tax credits for the working poor, expanding Pell Grants, health care reform itself helps people at the lower end of the economic scale, in an important way.
Well, he gave a very famous speech just across the street from us when he was running for election the first time in response to Reverend Wright.
It was amazing. And I wrote about this in there. Well, the thing that made that speech most amazing, and you know, you say when you raise the Floyd Patterson Muhammad Ali thing, that was probably the single biggest event that persuaded me that this guy could be the president of the United States, because there was a storm raging about Reverend Wright, his pastor, and some of the things he had said, and it erupted on a Thursday, and the president on a Friday night said, Senator Obama, you know, this thing's going to engulf us, and I want to address it, and I want to address the larger issue of race in our politics and in our country. And he said, and I want to do it by no later than Tuesday because I don't want this thing to go on. Well, he had campaign events scheduled Friday, Saturday. We had a film shoot on Sunday and campaigning here in Pennsylvania where the primary was going on Monday. And he said, I have to write this speech. I said, when are you going to write this speech? He said, don't worry about it. Just schedule it. So we scheduled it for the Constitution Center on the theory that if you're going to go down on a big stage. And he worked on it, he worked on it on the Sunday night before the Tuesday morning speech, wrote half of it. We went to Philly we went to Pennsylvania and campaigned all day. He came back to the hotel at 9:30 at night, finished the speech at like 2 or 3 in the morning, and I woke up and saw it on my BlackBerry, and I'm scrolling it. I'll always remember standing there in the dark scrolling this thing. I emailed him back and said, this is why you should be president, because it was such a profound statement. And, Marty, the last thing I'd say about it is the next day, you know, the news media was descending like vultures on Philadelphia thinking this could be the end. His supporters were incredibly tense. And I was in the green room with him before he gave that speech, and he was completely calm. And he said, look, the worst thing that can happen is people won't accept what I say, and then I won't be president of the United States. He said, but I'll still have said what needed to be said. And he said, that has some importance too, so don't worry about it. We're going to be okay. And I thought that grace and wisdom at a very difficult time for his candidacy was indicative of something very important. And I think voters interpreted it that way as well.
Is President Obama a liberal by the sort of standard definition? And I ask that because he certainly has his share of critics on the right. But I think there are some disappointed liberals or progressives who just don't feel like he wasn't liberal enough as a president.
Yeah, you know, the truth is when he ran for president, he wasn't considered the most liberal candidate in the primaries. You know, John Edwards ran to the left of him. Hillary was to the left of him on some aspects of health care. If you look at his history as an Illinois legislator, he was what I would describe as a pragmatic progressive. There's no doubt that he's got progressive or liberal feelings about the fact that government can play a positive role in opening up doors, in creating greater equality of opportunity and so on. But he always was one who believed that if you got 80% of what you want, then that's a victory as opposed to getting nothing. So I would say that he's a progressive, but he's not dogmatic about it, and that frustrates some of the more dogmatic people on the left.
Who wanted, for instance, single payer.
Right.
And still want single payer.
And you know what? He would want single payer too. I want single payer. But had we pressed that issue, there would be no health reform at all. And is that a victory? I think the answer to that is no. I don't have the luxury to tell people who didn't have insurance before, who do today, who have pre-existing conditions like my daughter, that, hey, you know what? We could have had a victory for you, but it wasn't quite what we wanted, so we said no, so I'm sorry, you can't have insurance.
That was my 2015 interview with longtime campaign strategist David Axelrod, who joined us to discuss his memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. And when we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with John Meacham about the first President Bush. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks again for joining us. One-term presidents have been a rarity in recent years, making the first President Bush's 4 years in office unusual, even significant. 41, as he's been called, faced almost as many challenges as those who have served two terms. So says editor and political historian John Meacham. He joined us to discuss Bush's life and presidency last year when his book Destiny and Power was first published. Let's take a listen. So why did George Herbert Walker Bush want to work with you on this biography?
I'm going to use a technical term. I don't want to overwhelm you, but I groveled.
Did you?
I wanted to do it. I had first met him 17 years ago in 1998. Michael Beschloss, my friend, the historian, and I had gone to Walker's Point in Maine. And I immediately understood in a way I had never before when I met him how he had become president of the United States. He possessed a quiet, persistent charisma and embodied very clearly a fading order of public service. He had more in common, has more in common, I think, with Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt and even the Founding Fathers than he does with his successors. And when the opportunity arose and he said that he had these White House diaries, that I just jumped out of my chair as fast as I could because what he did a couple of times a week for 4 years is he would dictate into an audio recorder. So in many ways, and the book draws heavily, the presidential part of the book draws heavily on those diaries, it's as close as most of us are going to get to being president. He's a one-term president, but he had enough action in 4 years that most people get in eight. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the budget deal that set up the prosperity of the 90s, the terrible 1992 campaign, the end of the Soviet Union, tumultuous time, quiet but deeply ambitious and competitive president at the heart of it.
Looking at his childhood, his upbringing, I mean, it seemed like a very stiff upper lip. It had a kind of British feel to it.
Externally, yeah, and that's one of the fascinating things is, yes, you're right. If you were looking at this boy growing up, born in Milton, Massachusetts, grew up in Greenwich, spent the summers in Maine.
Boarding school.
Andover, boarding school, Yale, the war. You would think of him as kind of having just stepped out of a John Cheever story or the Brooks Brothers catalog. But he is more complicated than that. He's more interesting than that. He would not have become president of the United States if he had only been that. If he hadn't moved to Texas in 1948 after the war, wouldn't have been president. The Democrats wanted him to switch parties in the early 1960s, back when there was one-party government down there. He refused. He barely got on the ticket with Ronald Reagan in 1980. Neither Bush would have been president had Reagan actually cut that deal with Gerald Ford. So his life is full of these near misses, and great biography, I think, is always the story of tension. And the tension in George H.W. Bush's head and heart was the mission to serve, taught him by his family, to whom much is given, much is expected, but the drive to succeed. And to serve in the way he wanted to serve, someone had to win, someone had to lose. And so you have this wonderfully complex interplay of ambition and service and duty all rolled up in this lanky guy from Greenwich. Yes, you know, he came from a privileged background, but we weren't really hiring him for that. 1989 to 1993 was a time of immense change in the world. And if I had told you, if you and I had been sitting here in 1980, and we would have said, all right, in 12 years' time, in a decade's time, the Soviet Union is going to cease to exist without a shot being fired, we both would have thought we were just whistling Dixie. And yet, because of both Ronald Reagan and George Bush, American leadership played a critical role. You know, they didn't end the Cold War. You know, the peoples of Eastern Europe, the peoples of the republics of the Soviet Union, the countless acts of courage, you know, it was their desire for freedom and independence that drove it. But Reagan helped and Bush managed it. I think they needed each other historically.
Those two, and Bush.
I do. I think Reagan did things that Bush could not do in articulating a case for the West. And I don't think President Reagan could have handled the management details of the 4 years where George H.W. Bush. And, you know, go ask Mikhail Gorbachev.
In fact, you have an interesting several scenes where Bush sort of holds his tongue in a way to give, I'm not sure it was exactly saving face, but seemed like Gorbachev really appreciated his diplomacy.
Here's a connection between childhood and the presidency. In childhood, he was George Bush was known as half-half because whenever he had a treat, he would cut it in half and give the other kid half the dessert, half the candy bar. Cut to 1990, 1991, 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. Half-half Bush is able to put himself in the shoes both of Gorbachev and of those to Gorbachev's right in the Soviet Union. He's able to imaginatively see how he would feel if his system was falling apart. And he knew that the possibility of a violent reaction from Soviet hardliners was a real possibility. And one factor, and we all forget this, one of the reasons he thought that in November of 1989 is why? What had happened in June of 1989? Tiananmen Square.
Of course.
So he had seen a repressive regime take military action against protesters. The wall comes down. He plays it very cool. The Democrats and the press think he doesn't understand what's going on.
Because he's not celebrating.
Because he's not celebrating. What he's doing is he's trying to prevent another Tiananmen. And he doesn't get credit for it until now. But it was a brilliant diplomatic move, and it was based on his character.
It's hard not to think about those particular skills at that time and whether they would work today at all, you know, dealing with all the dictators and ISIS in the world, you know, whether those kinds of skills are translatable.
I'd love to have the chance to find out, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a man who is the un-Trump. I mean, someone who spent his life training to be president. Someone who, ambassador to the UN, envoy to China, chairman of the Republican National Committee, director of the CIA, vice president for 8 years.
Those would be disqualifiers today for a number of people.
You can't. You couldn't be nominated. I mean, imagine that paper trail. Just for any one of those jobs in particular, the UN votes, having run the RNC during Watergate, even though he called on Nixon to resign, he did it late. Director of the CIA, who China, 4 years in Congress. George H.W. Bush is a figure out of a world that has vanished politically, and that, you know, centrism is not always the right answer. The middle way is not always the right way. But sometimes it is. And sometimes you need someone whose ambient reality is actually doing the business of governing. And that's what Bush did.
Well, some of his comments about Dick Cheney when he was vice president in his son's administration. Also, Donald Rumsfeld when he was secretary of defense in his son's administration has gotten a fair amount of attention, calling them both hard asses or iron asses.
Iron asses,
I should say. And about Cheney, he said he seemed knuckling under to the real hard-charging guys who wanted to fight about everything, use force to get our way in the Middle East. He criticized Cheney for sort of creating his own department within, I guess, the Department of State. Rumsfeld, and I have a feeling that there's some rivalry that goes back between George Herbert Walker Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, but he doesn't seem to like Rumsfeld very much, calling him arrogant.
Which is probably the worst thing that George Bush could call you.
To call you arrogant?
Arrogant. I think that's true. But President Bush, 41, offered these criticisms to me in interviews from October of 2008 through about 2012. I confirmed all the quotations with him again last year before publication. He believed that his son's administration had an overly hawkish tone. He worried that Cheney was too eager to project force around the globe. He thought that Rumsfeld had failed to revisit decisions once made about the conduct of war, of the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. To my knowledge, it's the first time he's ever been this direct, this honest on these three questions. He said that he did not believe his son should have used the term axis of evil, that hot rhetoric was good at getting headlines but might not be diplomatically useful. And I think the reason he's told me these things, I think, is he believes in the historical record. Mm-hmm. A man who keeps a diary for all those years wants the record to be to reflect reality accurately, and I think these were his issues with what happened. I don't think he thinks that Dick Cheney was really the president. I don't think he believes that, as he put it, you know, George W. was not some dolt, some dummy going in there. He did, that conventional wisdom is not right. And I don't think he disagreed with him radically on the actual decision to go into Iraq.
Different times, but different response to Saddam Hussein.
Different wars, different reasons. They both told me, and strategic environment was different. But more, even more than that, 41 wrote a letter to his son saying, you know, ratifying his course. Mm-hmm. You know, and in his own war in 1990-91, he was willing to risk impeachment if Congress had not given him the authority to go in, and he used the language of good versus evil. So, to some extent, was he criticizing in his son something that he was uncomfortable about himself? He wouldn't be the first human being to do that.
He called Lynn Cheney a iron ass as well, and seemed to think that Lynn Cheney and their daughter had undue influence on Dick Cheney himself.
Yeah, he was trying to figure out why the Cheney he had known as Secretary of Defense seemed so much more conservative. Cheney was always conservative, but he did bring Lynn and Liz into it. Vice President Cheney, he wore the iron ass label with a certain amount of witty pride. He did say that he did not agree with President Bush's putting it off on Liz and Lynn. They're two formidable women in their own rights. But it's interesting that that's what 41 was sitting around thinking about.
Yeah. What does he mean by iron ass?
Iron ass means inflexible,
data
resistant, stubborn to a fault. It's funny, I spent a long time on this book, and it may be remembered for the phrase iron ass.
And here we are talking about it on the radio.
Where's Bill Sapphire when we need it? The etymology of iron ass.
Let me ask you about Iran-Contra, because I have to say that even as you write about it, and clearly this is a man you respect and, mm-hmm. and have a lot of admiration for,
sure.
that this was a really dark time for him and perhaps a time when he really went against whatever his values mm-hmm. were. And mm-hmm. Is lie too strong a word?
No, I don't think so. He initially denied that there had been arms sales to Iran. George Shultz goes to him and says, "You were there. You got to knock this off." The argument, as people may remember, was George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberg, the Secretary of Defense, were arguing against the Arms for Hostages Initiative. The National Security Advisor, Oliver North, who was working for the NSC, President Reagan and President Bush, Vice President Bush, rather, were more or less for it. It was a misguided policy, backfired in many ways, and it made Bush appear to be someone who was not being fully candid by saying he was not in the loop. He knew plenty, and in fact leaked to the newspapers what he knew. I think it's an unusual.
Why did he do that, though? Why do you think he
get
did
it out
that?
Early? Get it out early before the 88 campaign. He didn't like the idea that we were working through a third nation. It was going through Israel. So I think it's an uncharacteristic moment, but it was a Machiavellian one where he was having to balance staying close to Reagan, who remained popular with the Republican base, and keep himself out of trouble. You know, that's one of the things about Bush that I think is important, and a lot of Democrats I've talked to who about this have said that, you know, this is the last Republican president they can really sort of get behind at all. And Iran-Contra is an exception to that. But this is a man who was never really deeply ideologically wedded to either side, left or right. So he was not driven by a fervor in the way Oliver North was. So much so that he was such a pragmatic figure as opposed to a movement conservative, that when he was president, he passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. He transformed almost every building in America for the disabled. He violated his own no new taxes pledge to put the country on a stronger fiscal footing. He signed the Clean Air Act, which is essentially still our environmental policy. He had a much bigger domestic record than people have appreciated. And I think the reason people don't appreciate it is it was too liberal for Republicans to embrace, and Democrats didn't want to give a Republican president too much credit. That's why history in this case matters. This book is my attempt to look at him whole and biographically. It's not a book about it's not a political biography. This is his whole life. And when he fell short, as he fell short on Iran-Contra, as he fell short on failing to explain why he broke Read My Lips, he fell short because he was human and frail and given to sin and shortcoming like the rest of us.
Do you think he was also ruthless? I'm thinking about the campaign against Dukakis, the Willie Horton ads. I mean, the way that – and there were some others as well.
Yeah. I think that he was willing to say and do what he needed to do to win. What ultimately redeems him, in my view, is that whatever he did on the way to amassing power, once he had that power, he was able to put the country ahead of his own political interest. My favorite example is in 1964, when he was running for the Senate in Texas, he opposed the Civil Rights Act, now a piece of American scripture. But what does he do in 1968 when he's actually elected to Congress? He votes for open housing, lifting racial discrimination from the real estate market. So he opposes the act on the campaign trail, the big Civil Rights Act. But when he has a chance to vote for a civil rights measure, he votes against his constituents' wishes. He goes down to Houston, gets screamed at for going out and selling out to the left. He is one of the last figures of the American center.
That was my 2015 interview with biographer and editor John Meacham about his book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. When we get back from the break, we'll continue our political edition of Radio Times in Review when we hear from former Senator George Mitchell. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We close out our political hour of the show by listening to my interview with George Mitchell. He served 15 years in the U.S. Senate, 6 years as majority leader representing the state of Maine. Later, he negotiated a successful peace treaty in Northern Ireland as a special envoy and tried and failed to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He wrote about all of this in his memoir, The Negotiator, which detailed his life in politics and his approach to deal-making. We spoke last year. It sounds like looking at your career, you thought you were going to do one thing and then you ended up doing something else. Did you imagine yourself having a military career, for instance?
I didn't when I took ROTC in college. I frankly did it for the money. We were paid for training, and I needed the money. I worked at several jobs while going through college. My parents couldn't provide any money for tuition. But then when I got into the Army, I loved it. I spent 2 years, just under 2 years, in Berlin, Germany, in U.S. military intelligence. I feel the greatest period of my life was when I was in college and then in the Army. I really learned in the Army discipline, reinforced the values of patriotism, organization, working with others. And I tried to re-enlist. But what happened in the meantime, I'd applied to law school. and the law school granted a one-year extension. The Army insisted on a minimum two-year extension. So I had to choose, and I chose to leave and go to law school. But I think those who don't serve in the military miss something great in life, particularly in this wonderful, free, and open country of ours.
Ed Muskie, former senator from Maine, was another big influence on you as, a young man looking at politics.
Well, I wasn't really looking at politics. I had no interest in it. I graduated from law school. I couldn't get a job with a law firm in Maine.
Why is that?
Well, I'd gone to night school, and I think there was then a little bit of stigma. I worked all during the day and went to school in the evening. Secondly, times were tough when I got out. So I took a job with the Justice Department. I lucked into what they call an honors program. I'd done well in law school at Georgetown. And I spent a couple of years there. And then I got a call one day from a man in Senator Muskie's office. He had a vacancy on his staff. He wanted someone with a legal background. He knew my brothers, knew of my brothers, didn't know me. So I went up, interviewed. And I was very frank to say when he offered me a job, I really don't have any interest in politics. I really want to get back to Maine and practice law. He said, well, if you'll commit to stay with me through the next election, which is about 3 years, I said I would do so. And during that time, I ended up finding a job with a law firm. Mm-hmm. And so I left him after the next election. But by then, I'd kind of gotten the political bug. And so I get into politics that way through him.
And we're almost up on a break here. So infected by this bug of politics, in what way?
I liked it. he was an impressive, tremendously impressive man, large, intelligent, very good speaker. And when I traveled around the state with him, I was like the driver, gopher, aide. It just seemed interesting and enjoyable, and so I thought that's something I'd like to do.
You did, at one point in your life, run for the governor of Maine. You did not win this, but I appreciated your honesty. One of the things that you write in your book is you were not prepared for the intensity of the post-election commentary, in which I was described as too stiff, too lawyerly, lacking in appeal and charisma. I read and listened to so much of this analysis that I eventually accepted it as true.
I did, and that's why later, when I was a federal judge and the governor called me and asked if he could appoint me to the U.S. Senate to complete Senator Muskie's term, I wavered. I wasn't sure because I felt insecure about the possibility of ever winning an election. And, of course, as you know, federal judges are appointed for life.
Right.
And, in fact, my brothers urged me not to accept the offer, to stay where I was. My brother Johnny said to me, well, you're a born loser, he said. You couldn't possibly win a statewide election, so you better stay where you are. So I then, after listening to that for about 15 minutes from my brothers, I called the governor. I said, Governor, I accept.
Of course. This was, though, a time when there was real comity, I guess, in the U.S. Senate. Bob Dole, I guess, was your counterpart for many of the years in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
You were able to work with him, and it seems like that's almost impossible these days. What changed?
When I was elected Senate Majority Leader, one of the first persons I called was Bob Dole, who was then the Republican leader in the Senate, and I went to see him. I said to him that I've been here very long, you've been here decades, and you know a lot more about the Senate than I do, but I've seen enough to know that these jobs as leaders of the Senate are very difficult, and if we don't have any trust between us, they'll be darn near impossible. So I said, I've come here to tell you how I intend to behave towards you and ask you to reciprocate. And I set forth really just the most basic standards of fairness and decency and courtesy. He was delighted.
Was this something new?
Well,
for him, you think? I
think his relations with our predecessor were rocky at times. So we shook hands, and to this moment, literally to this moment, never has a harsh word passed between Bob Dole and I in public or private. We became very good friends. We still are good friends. We speak occasionally on the phone. I recently telephoned him. It was his birthday. I think it was his 90th. Mm-hmm. And he's still physically having a tough time, but he's still sharp as a tack. And we disagreed on almost every issue that came before the Senate. We negotiated endlessly over procedures in the Senate and legislative language. but it was never rancor. It was never personal. It was never harsh. I think there have been a lot of changes, although I have to say it was tough then. We had some very tough direct debates and discussions, strong disagreements. I thought it was hard, but it was nothing like compared to what it is now.
I mean, obviously the goal is some kind of compromise, but that's become a bad word for some people in Congress.
To some.
Not all, but to some.
But that's a mistaken view, and it accounts for some of the intense partisanship now because, particularly in the House of Representatives, the pivotal moment in the election process is no longer the general election. It's the primary or the nominating process because gerrymandering has reached such a high state of precision that right now any expert can tell you who will win in about 75 or 80% of the seats next year in the House. Not which person, but which party. So for the guys, men and women, running for the House, it's the getting nominated that decides the election, not the general election. And as you know, we have a very poor record in this country of election participation, even in presidential elections. In the off year, it's very small. Yes. So that gives disproportionate weight to the more extreme elements in both parties. They tend to be more rigid, more ideological, more unwilling to compromise. I watched on television a couple of years ago as a Tea Party member of the House of Representatives stood up and said, compromise is wrong. It's what got us to these problems. I'm against any form of compromise. One commentator said, well, you know, that's ridiculous. This is a country of 300 million people, very diverse. You can't govern without ever compromising. He said, I'll bet 9 out of 10 people disagree with him. And the other commentator said, yeah, but he's talking to the one.
Right.
The one person who will participate in his nomination. You combine that with the money, the extremely excessive and corrupting amounts of money now that go into our political process, and I think you have a deadly combination that leads to what – there may well be other factors. I'm not a professional political scientist. Only time will tell. But I know those are contributing factors.
Why do you think you were able, along with others, to come to some kind of a peace accord in Northern Ireland?
There are a number of factors. The first was, I think, a general weariness with war and conflict. It's very difficult in these divided societies. People killed, people horribly maimed. Fear and anxiety, a constant factor in life. I think people had gotten tired of it. I think the real heroes are the political leaders of Northern Ireland, ordinary men and women who had spent their lives in conflict but who had the courage to make these difficult decisions in a very dangerous period, dangerous for them personally and for their families. The Middle East is more complicated, more difficult. Several intersecting, overlapping, sometimes contradictory conflicts in the Middle East. You didn't have an external presence like Iran is in the Middle East now. So it's tougher, but I think in the end, both Israelis and Palestinians will recognize that it's in their self-interest to establish a two-state, to reach an agreement on a two-state solution. And I think that will happen.
Picking up on what you said about the Middle East, and I mean, every conflict obviously is different. There's deep history here. There are deep hurts here as well. Do you think it is the job of the United States to try to play broker in this agreement?
It is in the interest of the United States to try to bring about an agreement. Our national security interests, I think, would be enhanced by an agreement that would enable Israel to exist behind secure and defensible borders. Hopefully, it would lead to the normalization of relations between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Even though now they have very common interests in many respects, they don't act on them because of this barrier that exists because of the Palestinian issue. Take the item number one of the day, Iran. Israel is adamantly opposed to Iran's getting a nuclear weapon. So is Saudi Arabia. So are most of the other Gulf countries. And yet their efforts are not coordinated in any way because they can't talk because of this Palestinian issue. That's just one small example, and I think you'd see that ripple effect throughout the region. And so I do think ultimately it will happen.
But how much does it require people who truly want to resolve a conflict, knowing, of course, how complicated it is?
One of the major factors in all these conflicts is the absence of trust. In the Middle East, it's not just the absence of trust, it's a high level of active mistrust. I say in the book that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas don't trust or like each other. That's a contributing factor. It's not the only factor. There are many others among the people. But President George W. Bush went to Jerusalem a week before he left office. On January 9th, I think probably 11 days before, he gave a speech in Jerusalem, which I thought set out very persuasively that the interests of Israelis and Palestinians is in both getting what they want, because neither can achieve its objective by denying to the other what it wants. The Israelis have a very, very effective state. They don't have security. They live in constant fear and anxiety. The Palestinians don't have a state, and they want one. But the Palestinians aren't going to get a state until the people of Israel have reasonable and sustainable security. They're not going to get that security until the Palestinians get a state. So they're vested not only in their interests, but in the other's interests as well. And President Bush made that case very well. I urge anyone interested in that subject to take a look at that speech. And it still holds true today.
I mean, would it be fair to say that everyone knows what the final goal probably will be? They just don't know how to get there?
They not only know the goal, they know the approximation of the outcome, been set out many times. President Clinton set it out when he left office in a major speech that he gave just before leaving office, what are now called the Clinton parameters. And it won't be exactly that. They'll be adjusted and modified to take into account subsequent events. But they know how it's going to end. It's getting there. That's the problem, because both societies are deeply divided. But remember, about half the Palestinians support Hamas, which doesn't recognize Israel. About, and I don't know the numbers in Israel, but many members of the government now take the position there can never be a Palestinian state on the West Bank. Mm. So no political leader is going to take a huge risk by making concessions, subject himself to criticism, if he doesn't think it's going to work. And right now they don't think it's going to work, so they refrain from taking the steps needed to get an agreement.
In your book, you talk about, from your own experience, and these are probably things we could apply to all of our lives in terms of negotiation. As you say, speak less, listen more. And as you say, listening is sometimes a really hard thing to do. Be patient, have perseverance, be willing to take a risk, and also learn how to compromise. Right. I mean, are those the sort of things to live by?
Yes. But underlying all of that, of course, is sound judgment. Taking a risk one day may be foolhardy. Taking it the next day may make sense. You have to have human judgment, and that requires not only knowledge of the specifics of what you're dealing with, but a certain degree of what we call wisdom, that is good judgment based on, you know, a lifetime of experience.
I was reading, this goes back to the Ireland negotiations, is that at some point you took everyone and sort of just put them all together, made sure that they all sat around in a room, that they walked together, that they talked together, and sort of, I guess, getting beyond the kind of impasse and try to get to relationship, sort of like you did with Bob Dole.
Yes, to try to create trust among individuals. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. When I first went there, they didn't talk to each other. They wouldn't listen to each other. It was two separate camps, which never the twain shall meet.
Yeah.
And I tried to get them together on human terms. In fact, when we met, we had a dinner jointly on the occasions you describe. I insisted that they not all sit on one end and only talk over there. They mix it up. And I said to them, no talk at this table about the issues.
Huh?
Talk about, they said, what are we going to talk about? I said, your wives, your kids, your dogs, your vacations, your hobbies, sports, anything but the issues. Because I wanted them to learn to see the other side as human beings, just like themselves, who disagreed on an issue, but also wanted the same things: peace, stability, prosperity, a good life for their kids.
That was my 2015 interview with former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, author of The Negotiator. And that wraps up our politics edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.